Hello, this is Fred Rivera and Dimitri Christakis from JAMA Pediatrics. Welcome to this podcast. You can listen to this and other podcasts on our website at www.jamapeds.com. Well, today we have two very interesting articles to talk about, one on childhood adversity and the other on concussions. Dimitri, let's talk about the one on childhood adversity.
Thanks, Fred. So this is really a thought piece by Jack Shonkoff on the effects of early childhood adversity and subsequent health outcomes. And I think as many of our listeners know, there's a fairly strong and robust literature connecting adverse early experiences in childhood and subsequent developmental and health outcomes later in life. One of the sort of seminal pieces around this is something called the ACEs study, or the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which was done about 10 years ago and followed a large cohort of kids, about 9,000 middle-income kids, and looked at adverse experiences early in childhood. They had 10 different adverse experiences and subsequent health outcomes. And the adverse experiences they looked at ranged from parental divorce to child abuse and kind of everything in between. And they really took a categorical approach and counted, literally just counted each of those equally, and found a linear relationship between the more of those children had in the first 5 years of life and worse health outcomes later.
Which is really surprising that they all seem to have equal weight sort of for these adverse adult experiences.
Right, absolutely. I mean, we would normally think that these things should not be used as a group linear variable because there's so much variability in terms of the impact. We think about divorce as being almost normative, but it was counted the same as alcoholism or parental death even. This led to the phenomenon of what's been identified as toxic stress. And toxic stress is the idea that children experiencing sort of a lot of stress early in life without an adaptive environment that can help them compensate for it have all kinds of short and long-term effects, many of which are biologically measurable in terms of changes in their baseline cortisol level. Even their telomere length now is adversely affected, and they subsequently have much worse outcomes. So there have been several interventions, population-based interventions, that have tried to address these. I think most people are familiar with the Perry Preschool Project and the Nurse Family Partnership Project, both of which have shown long-term benefits but have not scaled very well. They tend to be very expensive and not widely disseminated. And one of the points that Jack makes is that we really need to have a long-term commitment to implementation, dissemination, research. I think one of the more interesting points he makes in the article is that in 1965, the year that Head Start started, which we're all familiar with as a very successful program, was the same year that the Children's Oncology Group research program began. And the survival rate for pediatric cancer then was 5% for ALL. And 10 years later, it increased to about 50%, and now it's at 90%. But in the meantime, we really haven't improved the effect size for early childhood interventions much at all. And I think one of the more provocative points is that we haven't sort of committed the same level of effort to continuing to revise and implement and disseminate these effective programs. But one of the other points that I'm curious about your take about this, Fred, is that the biggest barrier, which is not addressed by any of these programs, is poverty. And we know actually from well-done studies that actually just raising families' socioeconomic status has significant impact, not just on ACEs, but on their health. And, you know, the war on poverty now is, 60, 70 years old. And
but don't say it didn't succeed.
Well, it did succeed. It had some success. But the war is not over.
Right.
By any stretch. And maybe that's also something that needs to be rethought. And I don't say that with an eye to, I mean, this is not an eye towards rethinking or removing social programs, but rather augmenting them or fundamentally changing them, because we do have a problem with wealth inequality. I think that these things aren't going to scale very well. They're not going to be cost effective if we continue to try to implement things in situations where there's so much social chaos, so much disarray, so much poverty.
Right. You know, I think the points that Shonkoff makes in this article is that we really need to take a much more targeted approach, this whole idea of a precision medicine. And each child has different psychosocial stressors, and their families do as well. I mean, he makes the important point that we can't ignore the parents, which obviously is true. Now, for us as pediatricians, that's difficult. What do we take on and what don't we take on? But I think that there is increasingly now programs that show we can help people to be better parents and more successful parents. I mean, we can, to some degree, not totally obviously, but to some degree, make up for the fact that they might have had lousy parenting themselves, but we can help them to be better parents to their kids.
No, I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, it's interesting because what he doesn't talk about is what's called kind of adaptive stress. And the interesting thing there is that there's also a strong literature that resilience is built by kids having a certain amount of stress, because stress is inevitable in life. You have to learn to deal with it. But having parents that are there to actually help them work through it. And to be honest with you, in some ways, certainly among higher-income parents, the pendulum is starting to swing the other way. We just want our kids to have a stress-free existence.
Right.
We drop in and make sure that there's no problem they ever encounter, which is also not healthy. There's that healthy amount of stress that kids need to experience, but they need to have parents who are trained in how to help them actually cope with it.
Right. And, you know, I think as we as pediatricians, the kinds of things we can try to do is to identify parents that are having problems and try to get them into some sort of parenting program. I think the other thing is that we as pediatricians need to do a better job of tracking kids' school success. We know that there's enormous disparity in inequity in schools, and that schools are really the one way of helping to raise kids out of poverty, education.
So let's operationalize that a little bit. So you're saying that the usual question of how you're doing in school and having the parents say they're doing fine is not enough?
It's not enough. And, I think you and I both experience in clinic that parents who have enormously chaotic and stressful lives, they know their kid goes to school and that's about it, but that they are not as engaged as middle-class and upper-class parents in the kid's school success, because they obviously have a lot of other things to do. I'm not blaming anybody here. But I think that we need to help to get parents more involved with their kid's schooling. So if their kid is experiencing school failure, they need to demand, which is their legal right, that the child be evaluated and get special help, whether it be an IEP or other accommodations, to be successful in school. In many ways, it's a human rights issue.
No, I think you're right, and it's actually, I think the IEP in particular is one area which really lends itself well to kind of micro-advocacy for pediatricians. So when we talk about advocacy, many people think about advocating at a large level, you know, either at policy or a level or at social level. But the truth is, as a pediatrician, writing a letter on behalf of one child is going to go a lot further to help that one child than just simply telling the parents
right
to do it.
And, you know, we in Seattle and many other clinics, such as those in Boston Medical Center, have a medical legal partnership where we have lawyers that work alongside of us and really can be an important force in demanding that a child get the kind of attention in the schools that they really need. So I think this is a very important article. I gave this to a couple of our residents in clinic last week, and they really were taken by it. And I think that this is something that all pediatricians should read and carefully consider. The next article we want to talk about in this issue is by Noah Silverberg and Grant Iverson and groups both in Wisconsin and in Boston, and talking about concussions. Now, sports concussions in kids are really very common. There are over 1 million a year that happen in the United States. And parents, I think, have a lot of concerns about concussions. They are concerned that they're going to have lifelong effects on their children. They're concerned about how long the kid is going to be out of school or out of play. And unfortunately, there is only a modest, I think, amount of information to guide pediatricians talking to parents about what to do with their kids with concussions. And so this is a study that took advantage of a randomized controlled trial that this group did, where they randomized kids to have prolonged rest for 5 days after concussion versus going back to activities more quickly, and showed that the kids that had prolonged rest actually had somewhat worse outcomes than kids that didn't have prolonged rest. In this study, they're looking at the issue of symptom exacerbation. So most kids will recover from concussions over a period of about 7 to 10 days. Only about 10-15% of kids take longer than a couple of weeks to recover from concussions. Well, this group here, they had daily ascertainment of their symptoms and tried to look at if you had kind of a spike in symptoms on, say, day 6, what precipitated that? And secondly, did that sort of prolong your course of recovery? And what they found out is that there was a good proportion of kids that had symptom spikes, actually about a third of the kids that had symptom spikes. However, the symptom spikes resolved really pretty quickly within 24 hours, and that the symptom spikes did not overall prolong their recovery. So the kids that had symptom spikes seemed to recover as well as the kids that didn't have symptom spikes. The one association was that kids that were more symptomatic in the emergency department, quotes, kind of had worse concussions, end quotes, were more likely to have symptom spikes than those kids that didn't. Now, they did find that there was a association of symptom spikes with having more mental activity, like reading, going back to school, the day before these symptom spikes occurred. But, however, it's important to realize that most of the symptom spikes were not accompanied or preceded by this increased activity. And most of the time that the increased activity the kids did were not accompanied by symptom spikes. So, overall, I think this is good news for parents in saying that your kid's recovery from concussion may not be totally smooth. They may have a symptom spike one day, but it's nothing to be alarmed about, and it doesn't mean that your child is going to have a prolonged recovery from the concussion. It also doesn't mean that their kid is going to have long-term consequences from your concussion. I think it's important for parents to realize is that there's no evidence that occasional concussion, one, two concussions in childhood, is going to result in chronic traumatic encephalopathy like we're seeing in NFL or NHL professional athletes.
So what is your recommendation around rest then now? The literature is still emerging, and it's very frustrating, for obviously, for clinicians and for parents that, you know, as many things in the early stages where we don't know, and then we start swinging around,
right,
either based on small studies or just our intuition.
I think the thing here would be, in terms of sort of mental activity, so-called cognitive rest, there's really little evidence to support that. And if your child is doing fine, have them do activities as tolerated. If they have a day where they seem to have more headaches, lay off for a day and try it again. Now, that's different than the return to play, where there's pretty good data to show that you should have a gradual return to play, and the return to play not start until you're asymptomatic.
You know, it reminds me very much, when people talk about the brain being a muscle, it reminds me of how we used to have prolonged bed rest for musculoskeletal injuries or even surgery.
Yeah.
Or you need to stay in beds, and it's come full circle. It's like, get out of bed as quickly as possible. It's actually better for recovery to not lay around, whatever the injury is. And part of me wonders why we didn't have that same thinking around keeping the brain active
to
help recover.
It was interesting. I graduated from medical school in 1974 and went to the University of Pennsylvania. At that time, the treatment for rheumatic fever was prolonged bed rest.
Right.
And Children's Seashore House, which is their rehab facility, started off as a rehab unit in the seashore in Atlantic City, and was most of the kids there were kids recovering from rheumatic fever, and they had to stay in bed rest for a year. And parents could only visit once a week. I mean, the things that we used to do to kids, and you know, because we thought it was the right thing to do, but it's obvious bed rest is not the right thing to do for most people with traumatic injuries,
any kind of injury in general. Laying in bed is not generally salubrious.
And the other thing that, you know, is interesting is we take children that have severe traumatic brain injury, we try to get them into rehab as quickly as possible, and insurance won't approve a child to be in rehab unless it can do at least 3 hours of active therapy a day.
Right.
So, you know, here you have saying kids with concussion, we shouldn't have any mental activity, but kids with severe traumatic brain injury should get involved in rehab as soon as possible. So there is this cognitive dissonance here.
Right. Well, hopefully we'll smooth it out in the next few years here.
Yes. Well, thank you very much for listening. You can go to this and other podcasts at our website, www.jamapedes.com.